Well, let's ask the question together then, is death really the end? Is death really the end? When I was a kid, growing up in the 1970s, it seemed to me in those days that life went very slowly. Just everything took ages. People would talk about it speeding up as you got older, but I just really couldn't see that happening. The world was a slow place. I remember it very well. And then by the time we got to the 1980s, in my teens, life was before me and the world went slowly, still too slowly for my impatient character, but even so, life picked up just a bit more pace and things were going faster. And then we got to the 1990s, and in my 20s it picked up a little bit faster, but only as much as to satisfy my thirst for change. Life was going a little bit faster, but not that much, really. And then we got to the 2000s, and I was in my 30s, and life seemed to go a bit faster still. And our children grew more quickly than they did before, and the gaps between the summers grew shorter, and the gaps between the Christmases grew shorter as well. You know exactly what I mean by that, don't you? And now here I am at 40, and we're in the 2010s, and you won't even be able to see that one as it whizzes across the screen, and life is going at such a pace that I really do need Karen, our church administrator, to come on to me and remind me on a regular basis of things that need doing, because frankly, my brain still thinks it's March or April, and here we are, well into June. Life goes faster. Those of you that are far more advanced in age than me will tell me that in my 50s it'll get faster than 60s and 70s and so on, assuming that is I live that long. And then one day it'll be over. And whenever that will be, that is to say the fast merry-go-round existence of life going quickly will suddenly stop. Or will it? Remember back to the psalm we read at the beginning of this morning. No need to turn to it. Let me just quote it to you. The length of our days, Psalm 90, is 70 years or 80 if we have the strength. Yet their span is but trouble and sorrow, for they quickly pass and we fly away. That sounds as though when you are in your teens, you will have the whole of life before you and you've got a guaranteed at least 70 years or maybe 80 years. And there are some here who are even older than that. And hey, don't need to worry about this subject of is death really the end, because it will come. And yet, many of us know that that is not necessarily true. All of us, I guess, know of people who didn't make it through infancy, who died in their teens, 20s, 30s, and so on. And one way or another, we all know that the ultimate statistic is right, that one in one of us will die. Let me read to you from another psalm, Psalm 103 this time, that's going to come up behind me. As for man, his days are like grass. He flourishes like a flower of the field. The wind blows over it and it is gone, and its place remembers it no more. And the world around us, you see, with its skepticism of anything beyond what can be seen here and now, hopes that there is something more. But as soon as that something more starts to impinge on life today, then you get this very straight answer that the bottom line is, what you really need to know is that when you die, you rot. That is the way most people live their lives, and that is the perspective with which the world faces eternity. I don't know, therefore let me assume that because I can't see it, when I die, I rot. But to come to that conclusion, you really must believe that what you see now is all there is. And the truth is, you and I know very well, you don't need to be religious to hold this conviction, common sense tells you that you know very well that there is much more beyond what we can see right now. And think back to, if you were here with us, when we looked at the subject in October, on one of these question mornings, of is anyone really there? When you say if what you see is all there is, what about if there really isn't a God, and it all is just an accident of nature, the result of a big bang? If creation is just a big bang, how do you explain what went bang? That is on one level, such a simplistic question. But let me tell you that there really isn't an answer to that. You could go up to Cambridge University and to the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory, and where all the cosmologists are trying to answer the question, and they really don't have an answer. In fact, the only way that they can explain it is to say that the laws of physics, gravity and all the rest of it, that we now take for granted, they didn't come into being until moments after whatever it was went bang. Otherwise, it couldn't happen. By the way, just as an aside, things that happen outside of the laws of physics, you know what we normally call those things? We normally call them miracles, by the way. But they don't like to give it that name. Come back to what went bang. The only answer that they have, in fact, is a certain kind of peculiarity. Which is another way of saying, we don't know. But it must be that way because there isn't a God. We don't know. But something did, and we're going to rely on that. Now, I don't know what you think. That sounds to me like a position of faith, doesn't it? And then how do you explain the perfection of the way in which our world and universe just seems to be designed? Was it all really just an accident? The fact that the Earth that I showed you a moment ago, a picture of it, is 7 million miles away from the sun, and were it just a little bit closer, a little bit further away, it would either be too hot or too cold, spinning at just the right pace so that the heating and cooling goes, so that there are seasons and everything just works, everything just seems to work. How come the universe smells and tastes and looks like it is designed if it's all just an accident? The Bible says that human beings and everything around them has been fearfully and wonderfully made. And how do you explain, getting just a little bit deeper still, the simple evidence of meaning? The fact that there is some meaning in the world, if in fact it's all just an accident, then there really is no meaning to anything. It's just the illusion of meaning that really doesn't exist. If it's all just an accident, if I knock over my tea, one of my kids, bless them, spilled their breakfast this morning. I'm not going to say which one it was. He didn't mean to, and I don't want to embarrass him. But let's say for a second that having spilled his breakfast on the table this morning and the milk and the cereal went all over the table, just imagine for a second that I'd stood up about to get a cloth and I looked down at that accident and I saw suddenly that there was a picture. It was a masterpiece, in fact. It looked just like the Mona Lisa. Well, would that suddenly mean that there was any meaning? Of course not. But the world in which we live has far more meaning than that. You know, that you get up in the morning for purpose, go to bed at night for purpose. We spent our time some months ago looking through the book of Ecclesiastes. Let me ask you to turn to it now for a moment, can I? Which asks this question about meaning. It's in the Old Testament. Ecclesiastes in chapter 1, page 469. We've covered some of this ground before, I know, but these questions do rather interlink. The writer to Ecclesiastes, page 469, looks out on a world and asks, in which he has big questions. And he paints a position that there is no meaning. And he says deliberately, playing as it were devil's advocate, Ecclesiastes chapter 1, he says, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Verse 2. If you're still looking, it's Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verse 2. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What does man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. What will be, what has been will be again, and what has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new. It was here already long ago. It was here before our time. There is no remembrance of men of old. And even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. Is that really your summary of the world in which we live? That you have no meaning to your life, that you're just like the spilt milk, and that actually, well, everything will just go on without you anyway. Is that the way you view the world? Is that how it feels? How it smells, tastes, looks? There are people that believe that that is true. And as a result, they cannot have any of what follows next. How do you explain morality? If when you die you rot, and the same thing is true for everyone, who cares how you live your life or for what purpose? In the end, it's just the same result. Whether you die at 2 or 22 or 102, what difference does it make? If it's all just like the spilt milk on the table, who cares? Who are you going to answer to one day? Anyone? One another? Well, you're not going to be there to answer, are you? So who cares? If it's all just an accident, then how do we define what is right and wrong? What is evil and not? How can we say that the murder of people is wrong when it's all just an accident, apparently? And yet we know that some things are just plain evil. Indeed, that some things are very wrong. So one of the early Christian leaders, the Apostle Paul, writes to the Roman Christians about pagan people and says of pagan people that even in their hearts they show that the requirements of God's law are somehow written on their hearts, because their consciences also bear witness and their thoughts now accuse, now defend them. Somehow all of us know that there is a difference between right and wrong, and the spilt milk can't explain it. And even if all of that doesn't convince you that what we see is all there is, well, let me ask you some big questions for a second. How big is the universe in which we live? Is it infinite? How do you explain infinity? How can you get your head around the concept of infinity? Now, you can't see or touch infinity. You can't give me an adequate explanation for infinity, nor anyone else. And yet, if the universe in which we live is not infinite, then what is it contained in? And if that is not infinite, what is that contained in? And if that is not infinite, what is that contained in? Do you know what cosmologists do in the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory I was mentioning earlier on? They say that what happens is that the universe must be so dense, full of things that we can't see, they call it dark matter, that there must be so much gravity that the universe pulls itself in on itself. But we can't see the dark matter. We call it dark matter because we can't see it. But it must be there, because otherwise we don't have another explanation. We'll spend billions of pounds looking for it. We haven't found it yet, but one day maybe we will. But let's just call it dark matter, and that will do. And even if they can manage to explain that, what about time, eternity? What happened before time began? Or perhaps more simply, what happened before you began? How can you get your head for a moment around eternity past, before the Big Bang, however long that was, whatever that was? And after you and I disappear, and so does our sun and universe and everything else, what happens next? How can you conceive of that? You can't touch it or feel it or explain it. But you know that it's true because you're living it. To quote Descartes, who was very wrong in lots of other things he said, you think, therefore you are. You know you exist. How can you explain these things? There are plenty of things that we cannot grasp, but we know to be true. Including, can I say, the wonder of birth and the reality of death. What we really need is for someone who has been through death to come and tell us what is on the other side. That's what we really need. Human beings don't like things unless somehow they have witnesses to explain them. Well, you can look around the world for religions and philosophies and ideas and concepts, and you will not find anyone that has been through death and come back to tell you, except Jesus Christ. The great news is that Jesus has done that. We open up our Bibles and we find this wonderful declaration that Christ is risen from the dead. Now, even before we get into the Bible's witness, let me say you can go places like the British Museum, I quoted previously, and you will find that historians confirm that there is more evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead than for the existence of Julius Caesar. You get the cleverest lawyer's mind. Let me quote Lord Darling, former Lord Chief Justice of England, who, having overviewed the evidence, said, "No intelligent jury in the world could fail to bring in a verdict that the resurrection story is true." Jesus is the only man to have had his birth and life and death and resurrection foretold before he was born. Think about some of those verses that we read at Christmas time about his birth being foretold, written 700 years before Jesus was born. We read every year these verses, "For to us a child is born," from Isaiah chapter 9. "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end." Here is Isaiah writing into a situation in which people know they deserve nothing but God from God but his anger and hell, punishment for their rebellion against him. All human beings are in that same state of rebelling against God. I refer to it in my prayer. The very fact that we're asking the question, the very fact that we're treating him as if he does not exist sometimes, as often we do, shows that what we deserve from him after death is punishment, hell forever. But Jesus had his birth foretold as a rescuer and his death foretold. Go back 1,000 years before he was born to Psalm 22 and this perfect description of crucifixion 700 years before crucifixion was invented. Psalm 22 describes it. We could read the whole psalm. We haven't time. I can count all my bones. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing. Or Isaiah 53, 700 years before Jesus was born, 400 years before crucifixion was invented. "He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we're healed." His birth was foretold. His death on a cross was foretold. His resurrection was foretold. Again, Isaiah 53, 700 years before he was born, "After the suffering of his soul, he will see the light of life and be satisfied." Psalm 16, 1,000 years before he was born, "My body will also rest secure because you will not abandon me to the grave, nor will you let your Holy One see decay." Do you see the point? The point is that because there is ongoing meaning after death, because death is not the end, God sent a rescuer to rescue us through death and out the other side. His great promises throughout his life, he told these things. Mark chapter 8, "He began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the chief priests and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed, and that after 3 days he must rise again from the dead." And you see, the certain knowledge that he did it, not by some terrible accident or dramatic statement, but so that you and I might have the opportunity of being forgiven and knowing God and having a solution to death. The certain knowledge that he did all these things, fulfilled all these things, gives us not the uncertainty of tomorrow, but confidence in tomorrow. So he tells his disciples in Mark chapter 10, "Even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." My life, my birth and death and resurrection were foretold because I've come as a rescuer to rescue you, said Jesus. And as he stands in that picture Charlie read to us from John chapter 11, with these two grieving sisters, in the full knowledge actually that he was about to perform a miracle of raising a man from the dead, he stands with tears running down his face in sympathy at their hurt, at the horror of death, and he says to them, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even though he dies. And to the disciples in John 14, troubled by all of the promise of his death, he says to them, do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God, trust also in me, for in my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I'm going there to prepare a place for you, and if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me so that you also may be where I am. How do you face the uncertainty of tomorrow? You do not let your hearts be troubled, because I have tomorrow in my hand. How do you face the reality of death? You recognize that by trusting in me, there is hope after death. In my Father's house are many rooms. Jesus said that death is not the end. In fact, like a kind of infinite iceberg, what we can see is only a tiny part of where our life is. You know how with an iceberg you see the little bit, but the rest is under the water, the dangerous bit? So the life that we live right now is just 70 years or 80 if we have the strength, or maybe a bit more if we manage to live any of those lengths of time. Actually, what there is of life, eternity, is still so much more to come. And no matter how good or bad life is today, there is a future with Jesus. And God's punishment and hell without him. But that future really challenges our priorities and values. See, I think one of the great dangers of talking about heaven and talking about hope in Jesus is it tests what we really value here. And religion, dare I say, even faith in the Lord Jesus, is much too easily just a kind of cosmic insurance scheme. That we live our lives trusting somehow in him and believing, truthfully, that we have heaven sewn up when we die, and therefore pretending that really doesn't matter to us very much today. But if death is not the end, and it isn't, and if death has been conquered by Jesus dying on a cross for us, and it has, and if there really is eternal life ahead with God forever in heaven, promised for us by trusting in what he has done, and there is, then that must surely both thrill our hearts with the answer, but challenge our priorities today, mustn't it? And our thinking. And our choices of how we use our time and our money and our resources and our energy and our goals and our aspirations and our ambitions. To quote the Bible, what sort of people ought you to be? Very many years ago, there was a man who was enduring the most terrible suffering. His wealth was stripped away. His children were killed by a series of freak accidents. His wife had mocked him and then abandoned him. He still had some friends, but as they gathered round him, they falsely accused him and blamed him for being in a situation which really was not his fault. And then his health failed him so badly that he smelled and was incurable. But this man trusted in God. And it was hard to hold on to that trust in the light of everything that happened. But he knew that God had a plan for his life, and that God had made promises to him, and that God always keeps his promises because God does not lie. The man's name was Job, and you'll find his story written in one of the early books of the Bible. And he could say, looking at death full in the face, he could say, I know that my Redeemer, the one that buys me back, I know that my Redeemer lives, and that in the end he will stand upon the earth, and that after my skin and flesh have been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes, how my heart yearns within me. actually, no matter what happens, death is really not the end. Does your heart yearn within you? Arthur Stace was a man who became a Christian out of alcoholism. He had a very difficult upbringing. His parents were both alcoholics. He was born into terrible poverty. He was an illiterate, but he became a Christian. He remained illiterate for most of the rest of his life, but he learned to write in beautiful copperplate one word. He was concerned, you see, that everybody should think about what happens to them when they die. He had come to faith in Jesus Christ, and he desperately wanted, with all of his shortcomings of not a great explanation ability or anything like that, he desperately wanted to communicate to people they should think about eternity. So for over 35 years, he would get up very early in the morning and simply walk around the streets of Sydney in Australia and write in beautiful copperplate the only word he could really write. It was the word eternity. At least 50 times a day. He wrote it hundreds of thousands of times on the pavements of Sydney. Mr. Eternity, as he became known, challenged everyone that he came across to think about the future. What happened to them when they die? Where are you going to spend eternity? Because it is a reality. He could grasp that. He died towards the end of last century. But in 2000, when his witness and concern was honoured, when his message was displayed on the Sydney Harbour Bridge during the Millennium celebrations, with the fireworks going off all around, there's a picture of it behind me. Everyone was challenged by Arthur Stace to think about eternity. Let me challenge you. Where will you spend eternity? Death is not the end. And if you're not persuaded, let me say, there is an eternity. Whatever you think you're going to do in it, there is an eternity. Where will you spend it? Knowing the rescuer and his love in heaven forever, or knowing his anger and punishment in hell? And there's no need for the latter, because he's given you the former and me. And let me say, if you are already a Christian and you look forward to spending eternity with him forever, given that death is not the end, what will you do in the meantime with your energy and life and resources and time? We praise God that death is not the end and that Jesus has conquered it.